It's the 4th of January 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Is CBeebies supporting vaccination the most controversial medical broadcast on TV since Sutty appeared on screen receiving a rectal exam from Matthew Corbett? If we can't bring Gerry Anderson back from the dead, can we at least re-marionate him? Can a popular ghost be said to be a zeitgeist? And why are LEDs so blinking popular? But first, the begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do so we can keep doing this for a whole other year, that's right, it's a topical New Year's reference, then head over to poddelusion.co.uk and subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. We really appreciate all the donations, and they help us pay all of the server bills and other costs associated with the podcast. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. But now let's start the show this week with a plug. Next Wednesday, the 9th of January, is the next meeting of London's Soho Skeptics Group, of which the Pod Delusion is a part. And this next meeting is a panel being put together by Jir Milinovich, who you may recognise from off the telly for basically being a professional nerd. She describes her panel as a discussion for girl geeks and girls doing, quote, what they shouldn't be doing. I started by asking her, what does she actually mean by this?
Well, first off, I might challenge you using the term girl to describe a geek, and that's what it's all about. Let me tell you how it came about first. A few months ago, Martin Robbins got in touch with me and said, hey, I'm doing this thing, it's called Soho Skeptics, and would you do a thing about women? And I was in the process of writing a talk for Ada Lovelace Day. I don't know if you know Ada Lovelace Day, but that's an annual event which is all about championing women in science, technology, engineering, and maths. And so the talk that I was doing there was about the lack of female science TV presenters. And so I was really kind of thinking about this whole issue about women, and we women always kind of complain about all these issues that we have to face on a daily basis. And I suddenly just thought, this has been going on for so long. I've been a part of so many different geek communities over the years, and the same thing seems to happen over and over again. So I thought, I want to do a panel about that, but what I don't want it to be is basically a bunch of women bitching. That. We've had enough of that. And you know that quote, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, right? I just feel these same conversations have come up time and time and time again. And so the panel, what I want it to be is talking about where women fit into all these different geek communities and how we can stop being referred to as girl geeks, as you said, and just geeks, right? Because when you label something as girl geek, then it means that there's this thing that exists, geek, and then there's this other, which is a girl geek. And it's something that comes up, as I said, it comes up time and time and time again. And I know, obviously, the skeptics have been having their own conversation sexism for quite a while. So what I want it to be is a much more kind of positive thing, because obviously I know that everyone's going to be on side, because I mean, I would hope that, you know, people in the audience don't hate women. You know, I don't think of skeptics as being that at all. So I think I want it to be just a much more kind of positive thing. And I would really like women to walk away from it thinking, yes, this is so awesome. And men thinking, yes, women are so awesome.
I guess to take things back a step, where do you think this sort of perception of women in science and technology and so on comes from? Is it a historical thing? Could it have gone the other way? Is it a recent?
I don't think it's. In fact, I was talking about this with Richard Wiseman the other day, and I was just saying, you know what? There's sexism everywhere, right? It exists across the board. It doesn't matter what community you're in, whether it's a geek community or not, right? There's sexism, and I think that the problem for women is we belong to these different kind of geek communities, and we assume that the people involved are better than the rest of society. And so it's more a kind of disappointment when we go, oh, and not even here can we really feel a part of it. There's this thing in psychology called microaggressions, right? That I think it started off when talking about racism, but it's also talking about women. So, for example, in fandom right now, there's a huge argument about fake geek girls. I don't know if you know about this. So young women who show their love for comic books or sci-fi with like cosplay, for example, instead of collecting things, which is the proper geek way of doing things. So male geeks in the fandom world are calling those women fake geek girls. And it's things like they might say, well, you like Spider-Man quite a lot for, you know, quite a lot about Spider-Man for a girl. And all these little things make women feel that they're not wanted or that they're separate. And the man that says, you know a lot about Spider-Man for a girl, probably thinks he's actually giving a compliment. And he genuinely is giving a compliment, and he might not have any conscious negative feelings about women. But the language that's being used says to the woman, you're not part of this. You're different. You're not a real, you don't belong here. And so it's those kind of real subtleties of language that women have to deal with constantly, not just in geek world. And it's sometimes, you know, it does get really tiring, and sometimes your patience runs out, and sometimes you just want to go, oh, fuck's sake!
So do you think things can get better easily? Do we need a cultural shift? Because it seems to me it's sort of things like, this is inevitable, eventually we'll get better, but is that going to happen? Do we need to be more proactive?
Well, my thing, I started talking about writing this talk for Ada Lovelace Day, and when I was talking about the lack of women who do science on TV, and anyone who doesn't know, I'm married to Professor Brian Cox, and a big conversation within the media is, where's the female Brian Cox, which already is offensive to all the women who already do science on TV, because, you know, they're Alice Roberts, not the female Brian Cox, right? And I thought about whether the complaining about the lack of women on TV does any good, or should we instead just celebrate the women who actually do things and be very loud in celebrating those women? There may only be 15% of programs presented by women, but let's just be really positive and loud about them instead of ignoring them, which is what happened. And so that's the kind of thing that I think I'm much more about, instead of bitching about things, just doing something positive instead.
But does that then feed into the recent debate on Twitter over so-called science communications and so on?
well, yeah. It does to a certain extent. I mean, I know Martin Robbins got involved in that, and I got involved in that for very different reasons, I think. But I think it is an element of that. And I think a lot of people said, you know, oh, just do your own article then. That is exactly how you want it to be, you know. And you know, quite rightly, people said, well, there is room for criticizing and what have you. And I think all of that got a little bit out of hand. But, you know, I do kind of think, you know, do something or shut the fuck up most of the time. And that's just generally, that's what I think when I read comments under YouTube videos. You know, I just think, oh, do it yourself or shut up.
I couldn't agree more. So, yeah, oh, sorry. Could you just talk us through who you've got on the panel on Soho Skeptics on the 9th of January?
Sure. Well, the first person I asked was Tracy King, and she did a brilliant talk at Ada Lovelace Day about being a, quote, girl gamer. And so I thought she would be really brilliant. She's got really great and interesting things to say about that. And then I thought, okay, who else can I get that will have an interesting take on this? And one of my friends who I started working with her about 11 years ago, we both started producing websites for channel4.com, and we did quite a few websites there, is a filmmaker named Campbell. She's on Twitter as CampbellX, and she's black, lesbian, geek. And I don't know about you, but in the media and new media, there aren't a whole lot of black lesbian geeks, and she's so awesome, and she just I just think she needs to be seen a lot more, and she does a lot of, you know, talking to arts communities because she does a lot of training for technology for artists and for marginalized people in order to kind of give them a voice and things like that. So she's got really interesting things to say about technology and being a geek. And then I thought, okay, who else would be just really awesome? And I just thought, it's got to be Maggie Philbin, who I met at, I think, the first live Ada Lovelace Day event. And, you know, she's just been a role model for so many women over the years who, you know, like technology. And she's awesome and, again, has really brilliant things to say about it. And she runs this... It's a thing for teenagers called Teen Tech, and it's basically introducing teenagers to the idea of going into technology as a career and giving them examples of the different varied types of career they can have under the technology headline. So she's got some really interesting things to say about role models for teenage girls and things like that.
Excellent. It sounds absolutely fascinating. I would say that because I'm involved in organising it. But no, it sounds fantastic. And we'll put links to buy tickets on the Pod Delusion website.
Cool.
We'll leave it there now. Jill Milinovich, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, you may remember about this time last year, we featured a groundbreaking interview with the bloke who used to play Tinky Winky off the Teletubbies to finally get the full story of his sacking. Now, just 1 year later, we've got coverage of another huge scandal that is currently engulfing CBeebies. This week, Dean Burnett brings us the news that CBeebies star Dr. Range has been encouraging children to shoot up with drugs. Well, you know, get vaccinated. And this has caused a right old shitstorm amongst some of the crazier parents. Let's hope he isn't thrown out of the round window and forced to take the playbus to the job centre, or else he might, you know, end up walking the streets like the Y-Bird. With more, here's Dean Burnett.
I have a son. He's currently 10 months old. Amongst other substantial changes to my life that he has caused, we now watch a lot more children's television in my house. I don't think he's actually watching it a lot of the time, to be honest. He's still a bit too young for that. It's just on to provide some visual stimulation, and because I'm not Susan Greenfield. Thing is, I'm usually sat in the room with him, trying to work, or just looking after him, because, you know, father, son, that's the sort of thing we have to do. So I've been exposed to a lot of the children's television myself, so I'm a lot more aware of it than your typical non-parent, or parent with grown children. I assume they don't watch it themselves. As such, I've actually developed some morally strong opinions about some of the children's television I've ended up watching. Thing is, a lot of people tend to be very nostalgic about TV from their youth. You probably see most comedians will mention it at some point. I'm sure Russell Howard has some rant about Thundercats and things like that. As a student, I lost count of the number of club nights and events based on children's television. Timmy Mallett, Pat Sharp, Keith and Orville, that sort of thing. And it comes to something when you can exploit the nostalgia of people who are still in their teens. So it's obviously quite an enduring effect, this cultural fondness for the entertainment we experienced when we were very young. It makes a certain amount of logical sense, speaking as a neuroscientist. Our episodic memories, the memories of our lives, our autobiographical memory, endure for our whole lives, but as adults, the earliest we can typically remember is from age 3 or 4. So our earliest memories will involve children's television in some capacity. Seeing these programs later in life could trigger these memories of our childhood, and we'll experience the warm, comfortable feeling we associate with childhood, you know, the lack of cynicism, no responsibility, endless playtime. You know, children's programs can let us briefly experience the joy of being a child again by triggering these memories, unless you had a particularly rough or traumatic childhood. And of course, before real life intruded and turned us all into bitter, disillusioned husks, spending what little free time we have trawling the internet for things to get angry about. So people have a strong emotional association with the TV shows they grew up with. But it may surprise many around my age, I'm 30 by the way, to learn that a lot of the shows we liked as children are still going. Thomas the Tank, Postman Pat, Fireman Sam, Angela the Ballerina. These are all still regular parts of the schedules. It isn't quite the same, though. Most of these shows have been modernised in some way. You know, the hand-drawn or the stop-motion animation, which we grew up loving, been replaced now by often quite cheap-looking CGI. It's a bit disconcerting. It's like finding out your childhood home has been converted into McDonald's. And, you know, there's quite a few who are guilty of this. As a Welshman, I'm particularly perturbed by Fireman Sam. Sam is now some sort of slick macho man. You expect him to start stripping any moment. He's that sort of firefighter. While his co-worker Elvis appears to have suffered some serious head trauma, he seems to be mentally deficient in many ways. It's a joke character, but still it's quite disturbing. And the children also now speak in some sort of horrific, sustained shriek. so it sounds like an episode of like Gavin and Stacey being reenacted by seagulls. It's absolutely awful. That's not to say it's all bad in the modern world of children's television. I find myself hooked on things like In the Night Garden. It's a show so soothing I have to avoid operating heavy machinery after I watch it. If I get the theme tune stuck in my head, I can't drive. It's that dangerous. And I'll happily watch Peppa Pig, even when I'm alone. I've got it on the Sky Plus machine. It's gotten to the point where I consider Daddy Pig my parenting role model, but that might be because I sort of look quite similar to him. At this point, you're probably worried that I'm taking children's television far too seriously. And that is a good point. I probably am. But recent events have shown I'm not the only one, and there are others out there who are clearly far worse than I. Another great program we discovered a little while back was Get Well Soon on CBeebies. My wife and I are both from a biomedical background. We've really gotten into the program, which basically teaches children about health, medicine, and what to expect when you go to the doctor. Sort of vaguely realistic way. All of the cast is made up of adorably diverse child puppets, like one is in a wheelchair, one's got diabetes, one's got glasses, that sort of thing. And they all see the doctor for various issues and concerns. The doctor is being the host and professional medic and brilliant eyebrow grower, Dr. Orange. Check him out online. It's formidable eyebrows. One episode involved, recently, one of the children getting the MMR jab. I have seen it. It's very good. It explains, in simple terms, the mechanism of vaccines and even includes the explanations of how injections work, including groundbreaking revelations like, this might sting for a moment. Can you imagine that in an actual show which tells kids that, oh, this injection, it might actually hurt for a second or two? You're not being overly paranoid, but when you tell kids, you know, it won't hurt at all, and then it does, and they lose all faith and trust in you. But imagine that, telling children the truth about a medical procedure. What could possibly object to that? Anti-vaxxers could object, it turns out. There have been official complaints about the episode by those wacky anti-vaccination funsters, this time at the Arnica UK Parent Support Network, who promote natural immunity, which is the same as immunity, because, you know, vaccines don't actually fill you full of nanobots. We're not the Borg. So the ludicrous and outright wrong nature of the complaint and some of the responses by Dr. Ange of the BBC, they've been documented by the Skeptocat UK blog, so you should check that out. Suffice to say, those opposed to vaccinations have interpreted an entertaining and well-thought-out programme featuring puppets as an all-out assault on the well-being and health of children. Perhaps we shouldn't be surprised that anti-vaxxers have suffered a complete humour fail. After all, humour leads to laughter, and laughter is the best medicine, and medicine is a tool of Big Pharma. If you do it, you're evil. I'm not going to claim to be impartial. I am completely opposed to anti-vaxxers. Every time they appear in the media, I make sure my son's inoculations are all scheduled and confirmed. If I'm there, I even ask if I can be vaccinated again too, just on principle. Can never be vaccinated too many times, as far as I'm concerned. Actually, last time I went, I did actually have a vaccination, and I asked the doctor, am I autistic yet, several times. It was funny at first, but then she got really weary of it after the first 2 or 3 minutes solid of this. But anti-vaxxers, we get it. You think vaccinations are bad. Despite all the evidence to the contrary and the discrediting of the scant supporting evidence that you spouted about so many times, you still believe and vaccinations are bad. That would be fine if all it was. It was just a matter of your beliefs. But when your beliefs pose a serious danger to others, especially the children you claim to care so much about, people are going to oppose you every step of the way. I've known people who, after 6 or 7 pints, believe they are fine to drive. They get quite passionate about this. They get quite angry about it. But despite the strength and passion of their beliefs, I do not let them have their keys back, because they would pose a danger to others. But perhaps we're misinterpreting the intentions. Perhaps the anti-vaxxers are actually upset by the tactic of using children's television to expose them to ideas and behaviours that they consider harmful. This may be a good point. Children are very impressionable. Studies have shown this, like children replicate behaviours they've seen on television, or on screens, or in media, or in any other format, without actually having witnessed it before themselves. They just learn by observing, and they mimic. So, is it morally right to convince children of a certain viewpoint or a certain attitude or a belief using the medium of children's entertainment? You can argue against this, and maybe the anti-vaxxers are doing that. Maybe they are actually arguing that the problem is not the what's being said, but the way it is being delivered. And this would potentially be a valid argument if those opposed to vaccines didn't use the same tactics. I mean, you would never ever find a children's book about how measles is harmless and fun, therefore vaccinations are necessary and harmful, would you? You would never find that. I mean, of course, you would. Just go online and check out Melanie's Marvellous Measles if you haven't already. Several commenters have pointed out the name is a derivation of Roald Dahl's book George's Marvellous Medicine. That's the same Roald Dahl, of course, who was violently opposed to measles and tried to educate people when his daughter died of measles. And his book has been interpreted as to a pro-measles, isn't measles harmless rant. I can only assume that the author, Stephanie Messenger, was unaware of the incredibly offensive nature of what she'd done. I mean, I'm just hoping this isn't the first in a series of books intended to seriously harm children. I'm not sure I could face the prospect of Daniel's delicious dog poo or whatever the hell she come up with next. So, in summary, people seem to care a lot about children's television, and that seems logical, given the reasons I've lined out. Children's entertainment is important to us. But what else is important? Vaccinations. People are risking their lives in certain parts of the world, like Pakistan, provide essential vaccinations to areas that need them, whereas those opposed to vaccination are getting worked up over a TV show about puppets. This sort of behaviour makes even the most basic children's TV show seem mature in comparison. Anti-vaxxers, grow up, get a life, and find something else to worry about. My personal opinion, and this is Dean Burnett for The Pod Delusion. This rant is also on my Guardian blog, Brain Flapping. You can check it out there if you want. It says pretty much exactly the same thing, but this time I've got hyperlinks. Woo! Also, as a afterthought, I'd like to say a big hello to Alan the Virus Graham, artist behind Exterminatus Now, my favourite webcomic. I followed him on Twitter the other day, and he replied, why am I doing following him? Because he knows me from this. So, that's nice. Hi, Alan.
Demographic news now, and it appears that if you're poor, then it sucks to be you. It turns out that in addition to not being able to buy as many things as rich people, then you can also expect worse health outcomes too. This week, Sean Davidson reminds us how the census is also exposing some of the staggering inequalities in health based upon class. I'm presuming this is because for people who aren't rich, simply looking at Jeremy Hunt's smug cunt of a face is enough to make you sick. With more, here's Sean.
December saw the release of the results of the 2011 census data and excellent Pod Delusion features on the change in proportion of people who identify as Christian. However, that was not the statistic that caught my eye. I live in the Northeast, where residents reported the lowest level of very good health at just 44% and one of the highest rates for bad or very bad health at 7%. Though this is not a new phenomenon, in 2001 the results were similar, it did get me thinking about social inequalities in health. Is it coincidence that in addition to having poor self-reported health, the North East also has the highest unemployment rate in England at 9.5%, the lowest educational attainment with a quarter of people with no academic qualifications, and a relatively high proportion of people in unskilled manual occupations? Put simply, the answer is no. In 1980, a report by the Working Group on Inequalities in Health was published by the Department of Health and Social Security. The report became known as the Black Report after Sir Douglas Black, the then president of the Royal College of Physicians, who chaired the group. The conclusions were damning. Health in British society was not equally distributed and the inequalities were worsening. The group concluded that this was not due to any great institutional failing on behalf of the NHS, but was a result of social factors. Lower socioeconomic classes experienced higher rates of morbidity and mortality, which the authors put down to their social circumstances, including manual occupations, poor housing, low educational attainment, etc., etc. Conversely, good health and greater life expectancy was associated with the exact opposite, high income. Here is a shocking extract from the report's conclusions.
Most recent data show marked differences in mortality rates between the occupational classes. At birth and in the first month of life, twice as many babies of unskilled manual parents die as do babies of professional class parents. A class gradient can be observed for most causes of death, being particularly steep in the case of diseases of the lungs. Available data on chronic sickness tends to parallel those on mortality. Self-reported rates of long-standing illness are twice as high among unskilled manual males and 21 times as high among their wives as among the professional classes.
But this was not all the report found. Not only was health unequally distributed, but so too were healthcare services.
Inequalities exist in the utilisation of health services, particularly and most worryingly of the preventative services. Here, severe underutilisation by the working classes is a complex resultant of underprovision in working class areas and of costs, financial and psychological, of attendance, which are not, in this case, outweighed by disruption of normal activities by sickness.
The fact that your health and life expectancy are related to socioeconomic class may sound obvious, but at the time many people believed the NHS would have rectified disparities in health. The Thatcher government was predictably unreceptive to the report's recommendations, and in fact delayed its publication until after the 1979 general election. However, in spite of their best efforts, it was eventually distributed and had a huge impact on public health and social policy in countries all over the world, with organisations being set up to address these problems. So what exactly are the mechanisms behind socioeconomic disparities in health? The three main theories are the behavioural, materialist and psychosocial models. The behavioural model postulates that certain negative health behaviours, such as smoking and drinking alcohol, are more prevalent in lower socioeconomic groups, while positive health behaviours, like good diet and recreational exercise, are more prevalent in higher socioeconomic groups. Materialist models emphasise the real-world effects of poverty and the health effects of factors such as damp housing and pollution. Psychosocial models emphasise the greater pressures and psychological stresses of having a lower income, and hypothesise that this may in turn lead to biochemical stress, which puts people at higher risk of cardiovascular diseases. Greater detail than this would require somebody more competent in the subject than I am. But if you're interested in the mechanisms of health inequality, I recommend picking up any textbook on the sociology of medicine and reading the chapter, or more likely chapters, on the subject. There's no doubt of the importance of the Black Report in recognition of social health inequalities as a reality. However, the idea that social factors influence health has been around for much longer. One of the earliest and most interesting champions of this view was a German physician named Rudolf Virchow, who was vocal on the subject throughout the 1800s. Virchow is a name you encounter frequently in medicine, as it is given to Virchow's node and Virchow's angle in anatomy, Virchow's triad in the physiology of clotting, and you hear about him in the context of his contribution to the cell theory of biology. However, it was only recently that I learned he was not only an excellent clinician and accomplished scientist, but also one of the fathers of social medicine. He recognised that disease is rarely purely biological and went into politics to address social problems affecting health. In Virchow's own words,
"Medicine is a social science, and politics is nothing else but medicine on a larger scale. Medicine, as a social science, as the science of human beings, has the obligation to point out problems and to attempt their theoretical solution. The politician, the practical anthropologist, must find the means for their actual solution."
During his political career, Virchow practiced what he preached, always aiming to improve sanitation, working and living conditions, with a view to improve the health of the population. In a slightly bizarre aside, Otto von Bismarck once challenged Virchow to a duel for opposing his excessive military spending in the Reichstag. Virchow could choose the weapons, so he chose sausages. Yep, that's right, you heard me. He proposed that Bismarck should pick one and eat it, and Virchow would then eat the other, the twist being that one contained roundworm larvae that could make you pretty ill. This game of roulette sounds so surreal that I have no idea if it's a true story. But supposedly, Bismarck laughed off Virchow's suggestion and the duel was cancelled. Virchow was one of the first in a movement towards a model of medicine which considers not only the biological influences on health and well-being, but also the psychological and social factors affecting health. The 2011 census acts as a reminder that health disparities due to social factors still exist today. In fact, the 2010 Marmot report, a full 30 years after the Black Report, said that in England,
"Put simply, the lower one's social and economic status, the poorer one's health is likely to be."
The worst part is that health inequalities do not only exist between socioeconomic classes, they also exist between genders, ethnic groups, and there's a vast difference between nations. On that cheery note, Happy New Year. This is Sean Davidson reporting for The Pod Delusion.
Sad news from over the Christmas period, as the creator of Thunderbirds, Gerry Anderson, died. Though I do guess at least now he's dead, he can finally begin to turn in his grave over the 2004 live-action Thunderbirds film. I used to love Gerry Anderson's work growing up, even though some of the acting was a bit wooden, and I always got the impression that it wasn't all as it seemed, like someone else was pulling all of the strings. But Simon Howard isn't as cynical as I am, and in this next segment explains why Captain Scarlet was actually all an allegory for the Cold War.
Gerry Anderson's work played a big role in my childhood. Like many of my generation, repeats of the Thunderbirds in the early 1990s introduced me to his work, and I was quickly hooked. I even insisted on having blue-rimmed spectacles to look like brains, and I even went on to watch the BBC's broadcasts of Thunderbirds in French a few years later when I started to learn that language. I even went to see the god-awful 2004 Thunderbirds movie. Perhaps I'll never grow up. But my obsession wasn't just about Thunderbirds. I watched loads of Anderson series. I didn't really get into the live-action stuff. I couldn't stand Space 1999 or The Secret Service. But somewhere, I have well-worn VHS copies of Supercar, Stingray, Joe 90, Fireball XL5. I really loved Fireball XL5, and Captain Scarlet. Captain Scarlet, or Captain Scarlet and the Mysterons, to give it its full name, was by far my favourite. I'm not even ashamed to admit that I occasionally watch episodes now. It's absolutely masterful television, and I say that as someone who can't normally stand any sort of science fiction. Captain Scarlet is dark. Seriously dark. It's essentially an allegory for the Cold War, broadcast while the Cold War was at its height. It has moral ambiguity in bucket loads. For those who aren't familiar, the series begins with Earth's security agency, Spectrum, conducting a routine surveillance mission on Mars. During the mission, they come across a bizarre alien settlement, inhabited by the highly intelligent but invisible and intangible Mysterons. Spectrum, falsely believing that they're to be attacked by the base, launch an unprovoked rocket attack, destroying it. Despite possessing the ability of retrometabolism, which allowed the base to be recreated in seconds, the normally peace-loving Mysterons are somewhat put out by this and promise a slow but nonetheless effective program of retaliation against Earth, which becomes known as a war of nerves. Their planned acts of retaliation vary from killing the world president to blowing up nuclear facilities, so all the sort of standard fare for this kind of series. Spectrum, of course, plan to foil the Mysterons' retaliatory attacks on Earth, and we have ourselves a TV series. As a result of the sequelae of the events on Mars, Captain Scarlet ultimately becomes a human with the power of retrometabolism, making him indestructible, and Captain Black becomes a Mysteron agent. And, mirroring the suspicion around Cold War double agents, the Mysterons are able to bring any dead human back to life, but under Mysteron control, meaning that no one can ever be sure who is on whose side. And also meaning, of course, that most episodes include somebody being murdered. By the standards of modern adult TV, that isn't really so remarkable, but there are very few kids' TV shows where that's true. And compare it to the Thunderbirds of just a couple of years before, who were heroes who went round saving everybody, and nobody ever died. Captain Scarlet is dark by the standards of kids' TV. Frankly, it's pretty dark for adult TV, too. It's continuously ambiguous as to whether Spectrum, as the original unprovoked aggressors, are the good guys or the bad guys. As the story's told from the perspective of Spectrum, there's a clear inherent bias in the storytelling, but there are regular reminders of the moral ambiguity of characters' actions. Compared to the dull simplicity of most TV, kids' TV and adults' TV, this is unusual. There isn't a clear good guy and a clear bad guy. There isn't a Thunderbirds and a Hood, or a Bond and a Bond villain. It's really left quite unclear who's on the side of the Angels here. Except the Angels are the fighter pilots, which work for Spectrum. But you get what I'm trying to say. Indeed, Captain Scarlet wasn't even ever designed as a truly children's TV show. It was designed to appeal to both adults and children. And as a result, Spectrum don't always win. Indeed, there's a whole episode in which the Mysterons comprehensively win the War of Nerves and destroy Spectrum. This is revealed as a dream sequence, but with the ultimate outcome of the war never declared in the series, one has to wonder. For the viewer, of course, the unpredictable endings give far greater jeopardy. Captain Scarlet was also way ahead of most other TV series, and for that matter, reality, in many other ways. It had a multiracial cast of puppets, including the prominent Lieutenant Green from Trinidad. This was broadcast just 4 years after Dr. King's I Have a Dream speech. Captain Scarlet had a team of female fighter pilots more than 2 decades before the RAF had a single female fighter pilot. And it had puppets whose heads were sized in proportion to their bodies. This was a series that pushed boundaries. And, pushing boundaries even further, this was a Gerry Anderson series that was successfully rebooted. The 2005 CGI version, Gerry Anderson's new Captain Scarlet, was critically acclaimed and ran for almost as long as the original, despite disastrous scheduling by ITV, which Anderson said broke his heart. It's available on DVD now, though. Tellingly, Certificate 12. And one script had to be ditched before it was even filmed to get that certificate. Gerry Anderson died peacefully in his sleep on Boxing Day, aged 83. He'd been suffering from mixed dementia for some time. Of course, Anderson's legions of fans around the world will have been very sad to learn of his death, and, like me, will want to remember Anderson for the joy he brought to their childhoods. I know that the thoughts of all of us at the Pod Delusion will be with his family at this difficult time. For my part, I think there are a few better ways of honouring Anderson than by rewatching some of his best and most important work. I'll be starting with Captain Scarlet. This has been Simon Howard, reminiscing for the Pod Delusion.
Now, the new year provides a good opportunity to take a look back at the year that has just happened, or perhaps didn't happen, or didn't happen but really looks like it did because there was a smudge on the camera. This week, Hayley Stevens has put together a list of her worst ghost sightings of the last 12 months, which includes, appropriately enough, a hooded ghost committing antisocial behaviour in Nottingham. Presumably, that's the ghost of St Anne's. That's a local reference. There'll be more local references where you are on next week's show. Here's Hayley with more.
If an insect flies too closely to a night vision CCTV camera, when you watch the footage back, you'll just see a fleeting glimpse of a blob that's glowing white, which is exactly what happened in the case of the car-jumping ghost in Nottingham last year. For those of you who don't know, in August 2012, a Mr. and Mrs. Wrigley from Nottingham set up a CCTV camera to monitor their driveway after a number of attacks on their car. When a neighbour had ornaments stolen from her garden, they kindly offered to go through the footage to see if they'd captured anyone around at the time of the theft. Lisa Wrigley told the press, "I'm absolutely gobsmacked by this. I've got the footage here. It's the image of a young child, about 4 or 5. We went through the tape to see if we could see anyone walking past our gate at the time of the theft and saw this weird hoodie ghost jumping on our car. It was really spooky. It was one of those weird feelings where you just think to yourself, what on earth is it? It looks like Casper the Friendly Ghost, but it was certainly leaping all over the bonnet of our Volvo estate." She added, "It's a ghost. It's got to be." Quite how she comes to that conclusion, I'm not sure. And just like the ghost, Lisa is making a huge leap here. The white blob that glides over her car in the footage doesn't resemble a child at all, and when you look at a still from the footage, it's quite obvious that it's an insect. This is the ghost that made the number 5 spot on my 5 worst ghosts of 2012 list, something that I compile at the end of each year. At number 4 was what I've taken to calling the Cumbrian Demolition Ghost, which isn't actually a ghost that goes around demolishing things in Cumbria. This was one of the first ghosts to hit the British headlines in 2012. After taking photos of a building about to be demolished, demolition supervisor Robert Johnson thought nothing more of the photos until he uploaded them to his computer some time later and noticed a ghostly figure staring out of the window in one of the pictures. He said, "It wasn't until I got home and showed my wife that we spotted the woman. You can see the jewellery on her and everything. I've always been a sceptic, but I have to believe in ghosts now." The Cumbrian Demolition Ghost was a tricky one to try and work out because the building it was taken in has now been demolished, so there's nothing to compare it with. However, working with the information that was available, it became apparent that there are several problems with the ghost in the photo. The woman, as it's alleged to be, is about 3 foot tall when compared to doorways that can be seen in the background in the picture. Not only that, but her hair starts about halfway back on the crown of her head, and she has a flat face with no features. If you focus on the empty room behind the figure, you start to notice doorways, shadows and corners, and flaking plaster. It's most likely that this apparition is a result of things inside the empty room creating an illusion. Once you see it, you can't unsee it, but of course, that doesn't mean it's there. Another ghost that isn't there is the spook alleged to haunt Clevedon Pier. This was a new haunting that generated a lot of media coverage in 2012, which in turn gained a lot of attention from ghost hunters. The haunting caught my interest when student Matthew Hells took a photo that showed a figure standing out on the pier early one morning when it was still locked up. Other reports included figures being seen at the end of the pier that vanished when people turned back to see what they'd originally seen, and the smell of burning toast in the gift shop that would just disappear. In February, I contacted the pier mistress, Linda Strong, for a chat about what was going on. I was told that there was already a very long list of paranormal teams wanting to go ghost hunting on the pier, and that I'd have to wait until at least May before I could get a slot, even though I just wanted to chat. I was told that Linda was unable to talk as she had meetings all day and was extremely busy, which I can appreciate. However, when I phoned back as instructed, I was told the same time and time again, and I was getting nowhere with the case. All the while, ghost hunters were going out onto the pier under the cover of darkness to hunt for ghosts, using pseudoscientific research methods and finding the usual evidence of a haunting. Not getting anywhere with Linda, I started digging around. By visiting the pier unannounced as a member of the public and speaking to the fishermen who used the pier for sea fishing, I was able to work out that most of the stories associated with the ghost of the pier were nonsense, and that the photo of the ghost doing the rounds was actually of a fisherman called Vic at the end of the pier early one morning. Volunteers and fishermen explained to me that the pier's open 24/7 to those who have a key, and that the angling club prefer to fish late at night. I was also told that the sightings on the end of the pier were probably people seeing things out the corner of their eye, including a cardboard cutout that tourists can put their head through, and a telescope that often catches people off guard. Speaking to one volunteer, I discovered that a lot of the volunteers were fed up with the pier mistress using the silly ghost stories to generate publicity for the pier, because they felt that the pier and the surrounding natural beauty and the history were stronger selling points. With this in mind, and because of the evasive behaviour of Linda Strong, I put the Clevedon Pier ghost at number 3 on the list. At number 2 were the ghost photos taken by psychic Ron Bowers at an old witch's prison in Essex. Although these ghost photos and the haunting they're associated with don't date from 2012, they were included on the list because it was in 2012 that they gained the most attention through the media, on Great British Ghosts, hosted by Michaela Strachan, and also on ITV's This Morning. After seeing the This Morning feature, something seemed really off about the photos. They didn't really stand out as Photoshop forgeries as such, but they just didn't look at all authentic. Deborah Hyde, the editor of The Skeptic magazine, pointed out that the body proportions of the ghosts were a bit off, and that the torsos were wider than they should be, which is a classic mistake people make when drawing figures. I also got a tip-off about a trick that involves palming small pieces of acetate with ghosts drawn on them that are then held over the lens of the camera to make it appear as though a ghost is manifesting in front of the camera. Anyone looking over your shoulder as you take the photo will see the ghost manifesting on the camera screen, which is done to add authenticity to the photos. And this is something that eyewitnesses have reported when the photos were taken by Ron Bowers. Of course, I can't be 100% sure that this is what we're seeing in the photos by Bowers, but it does seem quite possible. A forgery that I could be certain of, though, was the ghost that made the number one spot on my list of worst ghosts of 2012. The Gloucestershire Echo reported this particular ghost in June after a Cheltenham resident named John Gore contacted them to say the ghost of a baby had been caught on a photo taken in his living room. He told the paper, "One of my cats kept scratching at the wall and jumping up in the area, and we were always taking pictures of the cats. When we got it through, we were surprised to find the little figure just stood by the sofa. I've never really worried or had any ghost sightings before. We've had a few strange things happen, though, like the TV kept changing channels and turning itself off." The photo showed a translucent figure standing to one side and furniture on the other side. John instantly linked this figure in the photo with the strange things that had been happening with his television to create a ghost. The only problem was that the ghost in the photo was a fake, created using an iPhone app. I recognised it immediately as I have the same app. And normally I would have just rolled my eyes and ignored this story, but this one was different. The story went on to quote John saying, "I showed it to a lady over the road who'd lived there for years. She said somebody who lived in the house before us had a child who died of cot death. It's hard to tell whether it's a boy or a girl, but we've called the ghost Johnny Jr. and it looks to be about a toddler's age. Now, this coupled with the fact that the paper had included the address the photo was taken at made me extremely concerned for the effect the story could have if it was read by the wrong person. For example, the woman who lost a child to cot death in that house. It was possible that she was still local and would have read the paper and would have seen the address that John Gore lived at and realised it was her deceased baby people thought was in the photo. With this in mind, I phoned the journalist that wrote the story and explained to her that the photo was a fake and how it had been done. She was really interested and soon wrote a follow-up story explaining that it was a hoax and how it had been done. And this extracted an admittance of guilt from a friend of John Gore, who admitted that he'd forged the photo to try and trick his mate. So, although this was a relatively lazy hoax, it made the number one spot on the list because of the harm that it could have done. I can't tell you what 2013 will bring, but I can tell you with some certainty that at some point there will be a photograph published in a newspaper, maybe more than one photo, that shows a ghost that turns out to be a person, a hoax, or perhaps an insect too close to the camera lens. This is Hayley Stevens for The Pod Delusion.
Now, an internet currency has been doing the rounds for a while now, but will bitcoins, as they're known, ever be accepted as normal? That's what this next report is all about. So, is it time to cash in on the new currency, or does the smart money say that you'll be throwing good money after bad? Are bitcoins a license to print money, or is it proof that an internet currency won't work for love nor money? I could do these money puns all day. Here's Sarah Passmore, passing on more.
We buy things online all the time using credit cards and PayPal. We don't really think about it, about the technology involved and the security needed, or the trust in the institutions keeping the ledger. We have a certain amount of trust in banks and their record keeping, which assures us of our day-to-day transactions, and they have systems built in to protect us from fraud. But what happens when we stop using fiat money, money that derives its value from government regulation or law? What happens when we start using something else instead? Well, one of the things that happens is cryptocurrency, a concept of money that is so abstract it's indistinguishable from a scam. What I want to do today is talk a bit about Bitcoin, how it started, what it is, and what it may mean for us in the future. Bitcoin digital currency is today the most widely used decentralized currency. A single Bitcoin at the time of recording is valued at around £8.20, and with it you can purchase goods and services. Bitcoin has no central issuer and instead has a peer-to-peer network which regulates Bitcoin balances and transactions. It started in 2008 when a paper was published under the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto on the cryptography mailing list. The paper was titled Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. It outlined a purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash that would allow for online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution, and it solved the problem of the need for a trusted third party. The paper defined an electronic coin as a chain of digital signatures. It outlined an electronic payment system based on cryptographic proof instead of trust in a third party, and detailed incentives for working to keep the network secure. A year later, Nakamoto released the first Bitcoin software that launched both the network and the first units of Bitcoin currency. On paper, the Bitcoin network is currently worth over $100 million. So how does it work if there's no physical cash? For a full explanation, I recommend visiting weusecoins.com. But if you are new to Bitcoin, in short, they're transferred using software programs that connect to a peer-to-peer network. The transactions are verified by people using an application called a Bitcoin miner, which uses large amounts of computing power to solve algorithms. This is how the network remains secure. And as an incentive for their work, Bitcoin miners can earn Bitcoins by being the first to solve proofs of work from the blocks of transactions or through transaction fees. The process is virtually anonymous, even though every transaction is publicly logged. Anyone can see the flow of bitcoins from address to address. However, because the addresses are random numbers, this information can't be used to identify anyone. The benefits of Bitcoin are that you can pass them directly from person to person without going through any financial institutions, which means the fees are much lower, and you can use them across the world. There are also no prerequisites or limits, and your account can never be frozen. Of course, now you have this virtually anonymous system for paying for goods and services. The next logical question is, well, what are bitcoins being used for? Well, there is the usual gambling and pornography, industries which are often the early adopters of new online technology. And there are also a growing number of online merchants and marketplaces that accept bitcoins, including hotels and auction sites. And then there's Silk Road, an online black market operated as a Tor hidden service, owned by the dread pirate Roberts, according to the Wikipedia page. The Economist describes Silk Road as a sort of eBay for drugs, hidden in a dark corner of the web known as Tor. However, interestingly, the site's operators prohibit the sale of goods and services intended to harm others, such as stolen credit cards, counterfeit currency, firearms, personal information, assassinations, weapons of mass destruction, and materials used to make such weapons. Silk Road is reported to have a revenue of around $1.2 million a month. I wouldn't personally say I'm a fan of Bitcoin just yet, but as an emerging technology, it certainly is interesting to watch as it develops. But in the meantime, there's just too many unknowns, the most fascinating of which is that no one knows who Satoshi Nakamoto, the inventor of Bitcoin, actually is.
This year marks the 50th birthday of the LED, and to celebrate, this week Sean Ellis has been taking a look at the history of these lights that we now take for granted. Incidentally, this next report has three different settings. You can either play it as is, play it whilst blinking, or play it whilst blinking and playing annoying monotone Christmas songs over the top of it. Here's Sean with more.
If you look at any film which wants to give you the impression of high-tech gadgetry, you're bound to see the twinkle of little primary coloured LEDs. But LEDs aren't that up-to-date anymore. They're now officially over 50 years old. That's even older than me, which was surprising, so I did a little digging into their history, aided by the various 50 years of the LED articles scattered around the web. Tantalising glimpses of coloured light emission from ancient cat's whisker rectifiers have been documented as early as 1907, but there seemed no reliable way of duplicating the phenomenon, and it kind of languished for many years. But as the semiconductor revolution gathered pace in the post-war years, the understanding of how these amazing materials work deepened. In a semiconductor diode, a device which only allows current to flow one way, currents carried by both electrons and holes, which are the kind of the absence of electrons, and when these combine they lose energy as heat. It soon became clear that it might be possible to tune the energy of this process, and under the right conditions, the electron-hole recombination could be made to emit light. This led to William Shockley, the inventor of the transistor, and two colleagues, Howard Briggs and James Haynes, to apply for patents on infrared light emitters in 1951, and they demonstrated it in supercooled silicon. The search was on for a material with the right properties to actually make this a commercial prospect. Over a decade later, in 1962, Gunther Fenner at General Electric created an infrared laser diode using gallium arsenide, which was a novel material at the time. This inspired Dr. Nick Holonyak, who for other reasons was working with the even more exotic material gallium arsenide phosphide, to investigate its light-emitting properties. According to his calculations, the electrons and holes were at just the right energy to emit light in the red region of the spectrum, but it took him until October 1962 to fabricate a light-emitting device. This was, officially, the world's first LED. Holonyak's research assistant, George Crayford, furthered the work by introducing nitrogen impurities to fine-tune the energy and produced orange, yellow and green LEDs for the first time. The first LEDs were not terribly bright, but they were efficient, producing little heat and they had excellent longevity. In fact, many LEDs made in the 1970s are still working today. The tiny computers on the Apollo missions, for example, use 7-segment LED displays. One of the reasons for this is because they're also very robust, being completely solid and typically encased in transparent resin. Compare that to the flimsy filament of an incandescent bulb suspended in a glass bubble of vacuum. Innovation flourished over the next couple of decades, producing even brighter and more efficient red, orange, yellow and green varieties using even more exotic materials. Aluminium gallium arsenide for red, aluminium indium gallium phosphide for orange and green, but there was always something missing. Blue. The problem is that to get blue, you need a much higher energy than was available from any of the known materials, no matter how hard you tweak them. In 1990, silicon carbide was eventually persuaded to give off a dim aquamarine blue glow, and I have one of these early blue LEDs kicking around somewhere. You can't see it in daylight, and it costs 20 times as much as a comparable red LED. An interesting demonstration, but hardly practical. Calculations showed that nitrogen was, theoretically, the answer. As a replacement for phosphorus in the existing materials, it would boost the recombination energy into the right range for blue. But no one knew how to make nitrogen-based semiconductors that would form diodes. After many years, the Japanese researchers Masayuki Seno and Shuji Nakamura built the first gallium nitride blue LED in 1991. But it was Naruhito Isawa who invented a process suitable for mass production later that year, and by 1993 had found ways to increase the brightness of the emission by over 100 times. Tweaking the energy up using impurities again gave violet and ultraviolet light, useful in their own right, but by tweaking the emission energy down, the intense blue-green colour we now see in traffic lights was achieved, and then a pure green version. For the first time, LEDs now had high-brightness red, green and blue emission, which by mixing them together gives us any colour in the visible spectrum. This is exactly what you need for large TV displays, and the signboards at football stadiums are testament to this technology. It was also possible to use a separate phosphor to convert some of the short-wavelength blue light to yellow. Mixing blue and yellow light in the right proportions gives white, and the first white LEDs arrive shortly thereafter. More improvements in efficiency and colour balance came very quickly, and prices dropped as volume production kicked in. Today's LEDs still work on the same basic principles as their half-century-old predecessors, but the diligent work of materials physicists has enhanced their brightness, efficiency, and colour range by many orders of magnitude. What's next for the LED? I'll predict even more efficiency. As I record this, I'm sitting in my home office, which is 100% lit by LEDs. In the next decade or two, they will likely replace most other forms of lighting, both commercial and domestic, with very few exceptions. Don't believe me? Try getting incandescent Christmas tree lights these days. This is Sean Ellis, basking in the warm glow of recombining electron hole pairs for the Pod Delusion.
Finally this week, we've been speaking to the man behind a new campaign to get the Young Atheist Handbook, by friend of the show Alam Shahar, into every school. You may remember that we spoke to Alam way back on episode 145 about his memoir. This new campaign is backed by the British Humanist Association, and it's already well on its way to raising the money it needs. So to find out more, I Skyped the man running it, Ian Horswell, and I started by asking him to explain why he started the campaign.
I read Alam's book as soon as it came out. I got a hold of a copy and read it very quickly. Really enjoyed hearing about his early life, his childhood, and then becoming an adult, and how he grew to find that his beliefs, or what he'd been told to believe and taught to believe, turned out not to match what he thought was right. He made his choices, some which involved difficult decisions with his family, and this went on to lead him to be a science teacher, among other things. I found it a very interesting insight into growing up Muslim, and in particular, the fact that he made some similar choices to me and some similar decisions, I suppose, about what he believed, possibly for similar reasons, possibly for very different ones. But what really surprised me was how much I'd take for granted the fact that I could choose for myself what I wanted to do, what I believed in. And although my parents or family might not always agree, there was never any problem with it. And that clearly wasn't always the case for him. So I decided that this would be a good book for other people to read. I loaned it to a couple of people, and since then I've even loaned it to one of my students. But it occurred to me the people who really need to read it are young kids, teenagers perhaps, who are questioning where they are and where they belong and what they believe in. And one of the best places to learn to ask questions is in school. So why not, I thought, give them some answers to some of those questions.
Excellent. You like you say, you're a science teacher like Alam is. One thing I thought was interesting is in Alam's book, he talks about how sort of religious questions will often intrude in the science classroom. I mean, have you any experience of that at your school at all?
Yes, I have. Not often, but when it happens, it's usually quite determined questions from students, or more often, in fact, rather than questions, they'll just refuse to engage with the ideas. And the two big issues, as I suppose you might guess, are about the origin of the universe and the Big Bang, and about evolution. And it's very much it's a very challenging thing to deal with 14 and 15 year olds who refuse to believe that evolution and that the idea of the Big Bang aren't really ideas or theories in the way that common language uses it, that they're based on evidence. And if they want to disagree with those ideas, and they have every right to disagree with the things we talk about in science, but they need to bring some evidence, they need to bring some data, rather than, I don't believe it because this particular book says I shouldn't. It's a very difficult one to try and cope with. It's very interesting to have students who, although they accept my expertise, my interest and my belief about it, refuse to accept the reality of it for themselves. I suppose in some ways it's particularly challenging for students who are highly intelligent and hope to go on to medicine, perhaps engineering, physics, and yet don't believe that evolution happens. Quite a scary idea, thinking of a doctor who doesn't believe in antibiotic-resistant bacteria, for example.
Presumably it must be a bit of a minefield for you as a teacher as well to try and say the right thing without, you know, it causing a massive fuss or something.
Yes, it's very much a question of reminding students that what we do in science is based on evidence. And so I can always point to a fact or data from an experiment, whether modern or more ancient, and show that this is why we say these things are right. With some issues, it's easier to make the distinction. So when we discuss ethical issues to do with genetic engineering, for example, it's very easy to say to them, well, this isn't about what I believe or what you believe. It's being able to explain the positions. Whereas with evolution, it's not really a matter of opinion. So sometimes you just have to be ready to tread on some students' and toes and say, you might be entitled to your own opinions, but sadly the facts are there and can't really be argued with. I suppose I've probably annoyed some students by that.
Well, it's a fascinating area. And I mean, turning back to the campaign, donations have already been pouring in. The British Humanist Association have taken it up and are promoting the cause. Have any of the books actually started going to schools yet?
They haven't yet, no. We've got a very good discount from the publishers, Biteback Books, who are helping us out. And as you say, the British Humanist Association doing the majority of the administration work. They set up the fundraising page on Just Giving, for example. The plan is that when we get to a certain amount, we'll be able to get the first selection of books out, I hope, is the plan. It's gone much faster, to be honest, than I expected. I don't think we were considering it would be as rapid as it has, which has been fantastic. The response has been wonderful. We're nearly a quarter of the way there. It's been great to see both small and large donations coming in. So I'm hoping to update my blog in the next couple of weeks and hopefully get some more on the microsite that we've got saying when the first few books will be going out.
Excellent. How are you selecting the schools that will get the initial batch?
I've no idea how we're going to work it. It's going to depend on what works best for the administration side of things. We've had interest from questions, in fact, from campaigners in America and in Scotland about whether they'd be able to expand the campaign to those areas, but we're focusing on England and Wales for now.
So were you expecting any reaction from the schools when they received these books?
Yes, we were. In particular, the contrast with the books that we've received in the science department from some intelligent design groups that we've looked at, put on a shelf and forgotten about because we know they're not useful. We really don't want that to happen with the Young Atheist Handbook. The aim is to send this to the libraries or the librarians directly in the secondary schools, which we hope will make it accessible to the students when they want to read it and when they're ready and interested. It's not intended to convert. It's not directed towards the religious studies teachers, although we hope that they'll find it useful, and there's some materials available through the website if they choose to do so. But the idea is for the students to use it themselves in the libraries. If it sits there and it goes unread, then so be it. But hopefully we're giving one more opportunity for students to ask some questions of their own. So that will hopefully avoid any difficulties with the parents or teachers who feel strongly about it, because after all, it's another viewpoint.
Sorry for the abrupt ending there. The Skype connection was having some problems. But you can find links to find out all about the campaign at poddelusion.co.uk. And please do donate, because it's a very good cause. I hope you've enjoyed our first show of 2013. My New Year's resolution was to have more puns in each show. So head over to our website at poddelusion.co.uk to listen to over 3 years' worth of archives, as well as like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and all that sort of thing. And if you have enjoyed the show, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. It helps us pay all the costs associated with the podcasts, so we don't have to worry about that. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Dean Burnett, Sean Davidson, Simon Howard, Hayley Stevens, Sarah Passmore, Sean Ellis, and me, James O'Malley, with much additional editing by Liz Lippendorf. The Sketch in the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. The Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Florida, Mr. Procopi. Do you have anything to declare before you come through to arrivals?
Oh, it's good to be back and nothing to declare.
I'm sorry?
Nothing. Just hungry, that's all. Those in-flight meals ain't designed to satisfy an appetite. Know what I'm saying?
I see. And did you have a good visit in Mongolia?
Just business. Met with a lot of elderly businessmen. Fossils, really.
Indeed, and this is?
My seeing eye dog. I've got the paperwork here somewhere. Rex, sit. I said sit! I'll clean that up. Still, good for the roses. Do you have a shovel?
I'm going to need a dumpster for that, sir. He's pretty tall for a dog, isn't he? And standing on two legs, I see, with short protruding forearms.
Well, he's getting on a bit.
How old is he?
He's 65. Million years.
He looks a bit, dinosaur-y to me. Jurassic puppy?
Who are you calling a sick puppy?
Are you smuggling dinosaurs into the country again, Mr. Procopi?
No, just my seeing-eye dog and this parrot.
A parrot with four wings? That's a micro-raptor, if I'm any judge.
You seem to be very knowledgeable about dinosaurs for a customs officer.
Just helping the sketch along, sir. Now, that's two dinosaurs you tried to get past me so far. What's this third one? Saurolophus?
No, I've only seen you so far. I thought I'd get further before being caught, I must say.
The first two I can understand, but this third one defies all logic. How on earth did you think you were going to get this scraggy-necked old reptile through customs just disguised in a pair of silk pajamas?
What reptile? Oh, he's not with me.
Mr. Hefner, you're in the wrong line. Your wife's still waiting in the honeymooner's lounge.